Hi, thank you so much for joining us today on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. This is Modern Tech News. I am Labiba, and today we have the great honor and privilege of interviewing Dr. Vint Cerf, who is widely known as the father of the Internet, the co-designer of the TCP/IP protocols, and the architecture of our Internet. In today's interview, Dr. Cerf will tell us about what he has been working on for the past 20 years, which is the interplanetary Internet. And he will tell us why he believes that we are on the cusp of amazing things that will happen in science and as we start exploring space. Dr. Vint Cerf has written many best-selling books, including The Internet is for Everyone, and he has received many distinguished honors and awards, including the Alan Turing Award, which is sometimes called the Nobel Prize of Computer Science. In addition to his job as the Chief Internet Evangelist at Google and being a Vice President at Google, Dr. Vint Cerf finds plenty of time for public service. He served as chairman of the board of the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, ICANN, and he also was a founding president of the Internet Society from 1992 to 1995. In today's interview, Dr. Cerf will give us an overview of what he thinks today of the Internet and how we can make the Internet a better place.
I'm Vint Cerf, and Vice President and Chief Internet Evangelist at Google, but I also sit on the Interplanetary Networking Special Interest Group Board of Directors, and I've been working since 1998 as a visiting scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and I sit on the NASA Advisory Committee, which reports to the Science Mission Directorate, looking at missions that are planned for the future in the 2020s and the 2030s. So just for context, the interplanetary Internet was an idea hatched just after the successful landing of the Pathfinder mission, which brought with it a small little rover called Sojourner. Before that 1997 landing, some 20 years went by when nothing seemed to succeed, nothing landed successfully. The successful landing of two Viking rovers was way back in 1976, so for 20 years nothing was working. So there was a lot of excitement when the Pathfinder mission succeeded. And not long thereafter, in 2004, Spirit and Opportunity arrived in January of 2004 at two different locations on Mars. And in 1998, when the team that was handling communications for Sojourner and I got together, we asked ourselves, what should we be doing now, that is to say in 1998, that we will need 25 years from now? And we concluded we should figure out how to design and build an interplanetary backbone communication network in order to support manned and robotic space exploration. Well, here it is, almost 25 years later, and the 25th year will come next year in 2023. I think anyone listening to this broadcast will appreciate that we must be on the cusp of a major change in our exploration of space, given the return to the moon missions that are soon to come, and the amazing results at SpaceX and Blue Origin, with rockets that land on their tails that were science fiction Flash Gordon ideas from the 1950s, and now they're real.
The new changes in space exploration will be even more wonderful now because nothing landed on the moon for the past 50 years.
That's right. After the last of the Apollo missions, nothing landed on the moon until recently. The Chinese, for example, have landed something on the far side of the moon, plus an orbiter in order to maintain communication. And the Artemis missions, which are essentially the return to the moon for us in the U.S., have two components to them. They have the government-sponsored research component, primarily NASA, but in cooperation with others like the Japanese Space Agency and the European Space Agency and the Korean Space Agency. But also the private sector has been invited to participate. And that's new. And the other thing that's new, of course, is SpaceX and Blue Origin efforts. SpaceX, in particular, with a really remarkable launch record, not only number of launches, but also the intervals, short intervals between launches, multiple launch sites, and, of course, a highly energized Elon Musk, who is eager, as near as I can tell, to get people to Mars on the premise that we should be a two-planet species at least. And so he's working on his Starship that could carry as many as 100 people at a time as far as Mars. So the Interplanetary Backbone Network is now something that we anticipate is needed, and the Interplanetary Network Special Interest Group is, in fact, this evening, on the 18th of May, launching the first of about 20 lectures in the IPN SAGE Academy, and the chairman, Yosuke Kaneko, who is with the JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, is going to open the Academy with his talk this evening. Your listeners might want to go to ipnsig.org in order to sign up for the subsequent lectures in the IPN SAGE Academy.
The good news is that all events of IPSIG are archived online. So if you would like to watch the event of May 18 or any other past event, or to register for an upcoming event, please go to their website, ipsig.org. That's ipsig.org. And click on the top menu where it says events.
We have a significant number, measurable in a couple dozen, people working on implementations of the interplanetary network protocols, which have been standardized both by the Consultative Committee on Space Data Systems, which is made up of the various spacefaring countries, but also the Internet Engineering Task Force, which is part of the Internet Society. The protocols specifications are freely available, and the software is available in open source form at SourceForge.
The Internet Engineering Task Force's website, ietf.org, has links to the standards as well as links to hackathons and email lists. They have a special email list dedicated to helping women. It's called SYSTERS, Sisters Link. The website again is ietf.org.
We are, at this point, literally entering a period when space-based communication is going to become more common beyond simply the low-Earth orbiting satellites of, for example, Starlink and Kuiper and OneWeb. But we hope, taking advantage of the Deep Space Network, which NASA built way back in the early 1960s to support those early missions, that system is still running, big 70-meter dishes in three places around the planet, Madrid, Spain, Goldstone, California, and Canberra, Australia. Those big dishes will be used as part of a backbone interplanetary network. So I can tell you that for those of us who have been working on this for the past 20-plus years, it feels like we're at chapter two now in the story of space-based communication, and it's very exciting to be part of the program.
Why did they decide to have those three giant antennas spread out around the globe?
Well, first of all, of course, the reason for doing this at all is that we are sending spacecraft out there, and the scientific missions couldn't get their results back if we didn't have a communications capability, to say nothing of sending commands to those various orbiters and rovers on the surface. The second reason for doing this is that we are now convinced, we being the Interplanetary Network Special Interest Group, convinced that the beginnings of commercialization dictate that we should start a process now, which could take us through the rest of the century, to have a backbone network in place that can be run both by government components and by the private sector and academia, in the same way that the Internet has evolved from its origins way back in the late 1960s to the present day, where we have lots of commercial implementations and government networks and academic networks all cooperating with each other. So we're anticipating that would happen.
How is the design of the interplanetary internet different from the design of the internet as we know it?
Here's the irony. We thought that we could use the internet's TCP/IP protocols. After all, they work very well on Earth, and they surely would work on Mars. But when we started doing the math, we very quickly discovered that the TCP/IP protocols didn't work very well when the round trip times between planets could be minutes to hours or even longer, because the flow control mechanisms and the domain name system mechanisms of the Internet were not designed around things that would take 40 minutes of round trip time between Earth and Mars to do domain name resolutions or to handle flow control in the TCP system. So we had to invent a whole new suite of protocols. We call it the Bundle Protocol Suite, just to give it a name. We also included an underlying lower layer of architecture. So the Bundle Protocol Suite is kind of like the Internet protocol of the terrestrial Internet. And there's a lower level link level that we call the Licklider Transmission Protocol, named after J.C.R. Licklider, who was the first director of the Information Processing Techniques Office of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and who in 1962 conceived of a computer network that could be used for non-numeric processing, that is to say something other than crunching numbers. And he sent a note around to his colleagues saying, let me tell you about this intergalactic network that I want to build. So we decided that his name should be tied to an important part of the Bundle Protocol Suite, and that's why we have the Licklider Transmission Protocol. Could I just mention one other thing?
Of course.
The consequence of not having low latency, of having actually large and variable latency as the planets move in their orbits, we get farther apart or closer together. Oh, and we have the other problem, the planets are rotating, and we don't know how to stop that. So that means that if you're talking to something on the surface and the planet's rotating, eventually you can't talk to it anymore until it comes back around again. So we have a variably delayed and disrupted environment. We call that a delay and disruption tolerant networking system. And the new protocols have been designed to cope with that. And so we have a completely new suite to deal with the parametric space, which is quite different from the terrestrial Internet.
NASA's website describes why use the delay disruption tolerant networking. They often look for interns. If you would like to apply or learn more, please visit NASA's website and go to the delay disruption tolerant networking overview. And now Dr. Vin Cerf will tell us how people can find out more about the bundle protocols.
The easiest thing to do is to go to IPNSIG, Interplanetary Networking Special Interest Group, IPNSIG.org, and you will find a library there of material and references to places where the software can be found or documentation can be found about the protocols.
Hi, you're listening to KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Thank you for joining us today for our interview with Dr. Vin Cerf, who is one of the fathers of the Internet along with Bob Kahn. Dr. Cerf has developed the Internet Protocol Suite, commonly known as TCP/IP. As you heard from the previous part of the interview, Dr. Cerf has been working for 20 years or more on developing the interplanetary Internet, which will have the store and bundle protocols. And now he'll tell us a little bit more about these new protocols.
The return to the moon missions, the Artemis and Gateway programs, include in their plans the use of the bundle protocol. The Americans are building something called LunaNet, and there will be some commercial components or private sector companies permitted to participate in that. The Europeans have something, I think it's called Moonlight, and the Japanese have as well a network that they're planning to put up. And of course, what the Interplanetary Network Special Interest Group wants to do is to provide standards so that all of these different component networks can be made to work together in the same way that the Internet allows literally tens of thousands of networks to interact with each other in a uniform way.
Then in the future, private companies can work with NASA's LunaNet.
That's the expectation. Of course, one of the big deals about making anything like this work is all the costs need to be paid for somehow. So if it's a private sector company providing service, it has to have a business model that pays for the cost, and it might be selling service to governments that are supporting exploration of the solar system. Or it might be selling communication service to other for-profit companies that are out there mining the moon or looking for asteroids. Or there might be some other model where a wealthy entrepreneur or a wealthy philanthropist might say, I really want to see this happen and I'll endow a program to support it. But there does have to be a business model of some kind to make this a sustainable operation. And just as the internet has surfaced quite a wide range of different business models, it's entirely possible that this interplanetary system will also have a number of distinct business models that might vary from network to network.
So tell us about what can be sent, audio recordings of what's happening on Mars or the moon, or can they send videos, and what's the data rate?
This is an interesting question, so thank you for asking. First of all, on the moon, the round-trip time for this kind of voice communication is about 2.5 seconds. And that's long enough that people step on each other. I mean, if you've ever done a double satellite hop phone call on Earth, you've noticed how easy it is to think that the other person isn't talking, but actually they've been talking for 2 seconds, or at least a second, and you just haven't heard them. And so you step on each other, and you fall into a kind of over or go ahead or some kind of signal to the other side saying you've stopped talking. It gets much worse when we're farther away. So you can almost have a conversation with someone on the moon, and we did when we were running the Apollo program. But when you get out to Mars or to Venus or anywhere, or even part of the way, the delays are sufficiently high that it's more like electronic mail. So you can imagine recording something and then sending a file, effectively, whether it's voice or video or both. But it wouldn't be interactive. The science fiction movies seem to have somebody in orbit around Saturn having a real-time conversation with people back at Houston saying, Houston, I have a problem. It doesn't work that way. The physics doesn't let you do that. It could be tens of minutes before a signal would get back to Earth. So interactive communication doesn't work on an interplanetary. So you'd end up recording things and sending them to the other side in the same way that we might type an email message or record a piece of video.
So the bundle protocol means people send a message and it's bundled and stored somewhere.
Yes, it's very similar to the way electronic mail works, where you send electronic mail to the destination and it's held until somebody picks it up. In the particular case of the bundle protocols, because the connectivity is not guaranteed end-to-end, let's say from Earth to Mars by way of a moon relay, the link to the moon might be working, but the link to Mars might not be working. And so in the routers of the interplanetary system, information is actually stored in the network until a link comes up and allows it to be sent further on, which is different from the internet. In the internet, we don't hold anything in the network. If there isn't a path to the destination, we throw it away and expect the originating host to retransmit. Imagine you're trying to send something to Jupiter and you've gotten all the way to Mars. The last thing you want to do is throw everything away and start over. You want to hang on to what you got at Mars until the link between Mars and Jupiter is up and running. So we actually do something quite different from the TCP/IP protocols, where we don't store things in the network for TCP or the internet, but we do plan to store things in the network for the interplanetary backbone.
How? I mean, how big of storage, and how will you get the storage wherever it's supposed to go?
Well, the good news is that it's 2022, and now we have the ability to put a very substantial amount of storage onto our computing devices, whereas 25 years ago, it was much more limited. So we're expecting to be able to store a significant amount of data in the intermediate nodes of this store and forward backbone network, and things would simply be forwarded when the links come up.
And can you increase the storage as time goes by, of course?
Depends on where the relays are and whether they're physically reachable. The answer might be, well, if you have a manned spacecraft and maybe you put a relay on Deimos or Phobos or something that's in orbit around Mars, as long as you can get to the site and provide additional memory, you could increase it. But there's not any magic here. Somebody has to bring the additional memory module and install it. That's not going to be a trivial exercise because it takes about 9 months to get to Mars from Earth. to say nothing of the return trip. Figuring out how to increase the total capacity of the network is not a trivial matter. You could imagine being able to launch additional orbiters and maybe ground stations so as to increase their respective capacity. But making repairs or upgrading might be tougher because that means the person has to go and change the physical arrangement. Whereas if you just send a new unit, it sets up in operation somewhere on Mars, then becomes a part of the network. So upgrading by changing a particular destination site might be harder than just setting up a new site with fresh capacity.
Hi, you're listening to KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our guest today is Dr. Vint Cerf, who helped invent the internet. Dr. Vint Cerf is also the chief evangelist at Google and has been working on the interplanetary internet. In this section, he shares with us how decisions are made about the interplanetary internet.
We have a number of working groups in the Interplanetary Network Special Interest Group. One looking at pilot projects, actually testing things terrestrially and out in space when we can get access to space-based resources. We have another group that is dealing with the documentation of the library that I mentioned earlier. And yet another group is looking at the policy questions that come up. What's the architecture of the network? How do the various players interact with each other? And how do we establish policy for such a system? That's interesting because at the moment, the desirable property of space communication is to avoid militarization if we can. And yet we already know that at least near Earth, there has already been some militarization of space with anti-satellite missiles, for example. There are all kinds of policy questions associated with what it means to own property on the moon or on Mars. Are we allowed to do that? What if there are competing interests on the surface of Mars or on the moon? How do you resolve conflicts? What jurisdiction does a court have? And I'm sure you listeners will be able to come up with other questions that are quite complex. So how do we discipline space in the same way that, you know, the American West eventually got settled is still an open question, and it's going to take a lot of diplomatic discussion to sort it out. I will say that the Return to the Moon mission, the Artemis mission, has something called the Artemis Accords, which are an attempt to deal with that particular question, at least in part. And it turns out that that's the beginning of this architecture and policy working group, which is meeting under the auspices of IPN-SIG. We've drawn in experts from other space agencies, from the diplomatic State Department, from the National Council on Space or Space Council. So there are some very senior people who are quite interested in this problem, as are we, hoping to create an environment where it's a friendly place in which to work. It's a little bit like the situation in Antarctica, with one exception. Antarctica, basically, there are countries that claim ownership of, but they have essentially decided not to make any official claims, even though Antarctica is sort of sliced up in a number of jurisdictions. But at the moment, everybody treats it as sacrosanct territory. Please don't leave any trash. Clean up after yourself. There is this really interesting question that if somebody goes to the moon and starts a mine, a commercial mining operation, what obligations do they have about protecting the environment of the moon? What about important heritage sites like the place where the Apollo 11 landed? In which jurisdiction will you settle disputes? What about frequency allocation so that you don't get into a big tangle with communication, radio-based communication? All of that has to be sorted out. So it's going to be a really interesting decade, I think.
I thought it was sorted out by the United Nations.
Well, yes and no. Mostly, I think, you're seeing bilateral and multilateral agreements among the various spacefaring countries. So hence the Consultative Committee on Space Data Systems, which is not, to my knowledge, a UN agency.
What kind of agency is it?
Well, it's an international organization,
okay,
but it's not necessarily, it's based here in Washington, D.C., and it's populated by the countries who are spacefaring nations, but I don't think that it has a specific imprimatur under the U.N. I think the United Nations probably has a group associated with almost anything you can think of. So the answer is that if they do, we have not yet encountered them, and our focus of attention at the moment is on the space agencies themselves plus the consultative committee. And of course, IPN-SIG, which is a special interest group of the Internet Society, which is an international organization.
The website for the Consultative Committee for Space is ccsds.org. That's ccsds.org. And now Dr. Vince Cerf will tell us about who does join the Consultative Committee for Space.
Well, I think that you have to be, I'm not an expert here, but you have to have a space agency in order to join. So the Interplanetary Networking Special Interest Group members are not members of CCSDS, although the individuals who are part of IPN-SIG also happen to be part of the Consultative Committee work, standardization of the interplanetary protocols. That's how we've been able to get parallel standardization in the Internet Engineering Task Force and in the Consultative Committee.
You mentioned mining on the moon. Do you think there is a specific business or lines of business that will start on the moon before others?
I think there will be several. One, it's conceivable that somebody will decide to try to offer telecommunication services for anyone landing on the moon. Those initial landings would probably be mostly exploration research and exploration and possibly some commercial mining if it turns out that there are things discovered on the moon that are attractive to get out of the ground, so to speak. I think in the longer term, believe it or not, a kind of a tourist possibility. It's already, as you've seen, the case that some of the spacefaring companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin are offering or planning to offer suborbital and orbital flights and experiences. And you can imagine a hotel chain, you know, deciding to build hotels in space and maybe someday even hotels on the moon. So it would not surprise me to hear someone claiming that that's the plan.
How do you think communication will happen on the interplanetary internet? Do you think we can send radio signals and programming from the Earth to the moon and beyond?
In a network like the internet, anything can come from anywhere and go anywhere else. So things could originate on the moon, they could originate on Earth, they could originate in orbit, they could originate in a spacecraft that's on its way to Mars. It could be literally anything. If this backbone network works as we hope it does, it won't matter where the information starts.
Do you know of any telecommunication companies that might start offering services on the moon?
So the answer is yes, although I'm not sure I can rattle off the names instantly, but there are commercial sector companies that are participating in the commercial lunar program. It's called CLPS, C-L-P-S, mm-hmm. that NASA has established. So my understanding is that during the return to the moon that there will be commercial entities offering radio-based communication service either locally on the moon and also from the moon back to Earth.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us today on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM for our interview with Dr. Vince Cerf about the interplanetary internet and the bundle protocols which he helped invent. These protocols will enable the delay-tolerant networking, better known as DTN, which will be used in outer space.
Protocols work essentially in almost any delay and disrupted environment, so they work very well. In low-latency environments, they're very much like the Internet protocols. In high latency environments, they are different because they cope with the high latency by storing things in the network when that's necessary. So we've done tests to make sure that the bundle protocol suite will run very fast and also with low latency, if the conditions permit that. So we've done optical tests, for example, at 600 megabits a second, which, by the way, is an important evolution in deep space communication. To move from radio-based communication to optical communication increases the absolute data rate that we're capable of supporting, and that's quite exciting.
Could you give us an idea about how these bundle protocols were tested?
Actually, most of the tests have been done collectively with the space agencies themselves who have assets in space or assets on the ground. We're beginning to do tests with other companies. Some of them are small startups that are interested in exploring commercial possibilities of the interplanetary networking. So I'm expecting that activity will grow over time. We've been very fortunate during the development of these protocols that NASA has made it possible for us to get access to some spacecraft that are already out there for scientific purposes and have completed their primary missions. They've allowed us to upload our software and test it, you know, some distance away. And so I hope that collaboration will continue, but at some point, especially during the return to the moon, there will be radio-based assets that are potentially available for our experimentation and testing.
How long would it take for a signal to travel from Earth to Mars?
It's 7 minutes. It's 7 minutes. At the speed of light, the round trip between Earth and Mars when we're closest together in our orbit is 7 minutes, roughly. And when we're farthest apart in our orbits, the round trip time is 40 minutes, which gives you a sense for the distances that we're talking about. It's funny because we say 35 million miles is when we're closest to each other, Earth and Mars. And that takes literally 3.5 minutes one way at the speed of light. And when we're farthest apart in our orbits, it takes 20 minutes one way at the speed of light to get between Earth and Mars. It's about 235 million miles. It's a little hard to accept that light is so slow that it takes that long to deliver a message one way.
How do you think future missions to Mars will deal with this kind of delay?
Well, it's not too different than dealing with electronic mail. That's clearly a store and forward operation, and it's not real time. There are things that we do on the Internet that are not real time, email and often file transfers. But we also do real-time things like streaming audio and video, and it makes sense where the parties are not too far apart. So I can easily imagine streaming audio and video on the moon, for example, whereas I'm not sure it would work very well between Earth and the moon. And it certainly won't work very well between Earth and Mars.
Why wouldn't it work between Earth and the moon?
Well, it's the delay and the disruption that makes it not work in real time. It can't because the speed of light is so slow. That's why you can't have the scenario that in the typical science fiction movie, I think I mentioned this earlier, where you're in orbit around Titan in Saturn and you have a problem, and so you're shown in the movie having a real-time conversation with Houston. Well, that would never happen in real life, but it would make for a very boring movie if you had to wait 15 minutes between somebody saying something.
Could you give us a summary of the test plans for the bundle protocols?
We are currently doing a lot of terrestrial testing, but the latencies are fairly low. But that's to just reassure ourselves that the implementations work under load. When the moon missions start with the Artemis return, then we'll get an opportunity to test this in situ between Earth and the moon. And in the meantime, there are spacecraft that are out there, some of which could be reprogrammed to do this sort of store and forward networking that we've developed for the interplanetary backbone network. And so I think that there will be opportunities for us to explore how well or how poorly these implementations actually run. That's why it's all so exciting, because there's a potential for trying things out not very long from now.
Thank you. interplanetary internet protocols work, and what would happen today if someone landed on the moon without those protocols being ready?
But protocols will be on board the return to the moon missions, and there's an intent to put up relay capability either in orbit around the moon, which is what the Chinese have done with their lander on the far side. We can do the same thing. So we would expect to have orbiting satellites providing communications, continuous communications. That's what the LunaNet design is about, which NASA is working on.
Okay, so the LunaNet, when will that be available?
Probably in the mid to late 2020s. In the early stages of landing, even before the interplanetary protocols are fully implemented, there are point-to-point links from the deep space network that are available. It will be much easier to maintain communications when we have multiple orbiting satellites that are acting as relays.
Who at NASA is building the LunaNet?
The Goddard Space Flight Center is in charge of building the LunaNet project.
Hi, thank you for joining us today for our interview with Dr. Vint Cerf, the Chief Internet Evangelist at Google. In this section of the interview, Dr. Cerf will give us some of the latest news at Google.
There are lots of things, some of which haven't been announced, and I can't share them with you, but I can tell you that the company is making very significant progress introducing machine learning into a wide range of products. Some of them have been quite exciting from the accessibility point of view. For example, there's an app you can run on your mobile called Live Transcribe. It takes sound in and interprets it as text in about 100 different languages. So if you're in an environment where you can't hear and someone speaks to the microphone on your mobile, you see what they're saying. That's an example of some of the interesting things they've done on accessibility. Another example is that the Chrome browser now automatically captions anything coming in that it detects as sound. And that's all very dependent on artificial intelligence. So there's a lot going on there. There's a lot also going on as we expand our capacity to support users around the world. We're starting to build or rebuild our optical fiber networks. The intent is to make for an incredibly large-scale and robust system. You can see investments along those lines. Another thing you're going to see is investments in the developing world in the global south, trying to find ways of making sustainable models that others can use to make money.
How does a company like Google make decisions on which projects to launch, where to launch them, and when?
Given the broad range of products and services that Google offers, we'd have to be more specific. But generally speaking, because we find terms and conditions vary from country to country, often we end up announcing and serving new applications country by country. Sometimes maybe all of Europe might be able to do something concurrently. A lot of what goes into product release is figuring out in which country is it most advantageous to do first and then learn from that and then try to deploy in other parts of the world as well.
At one point you mentioned, in a previous interview, you mentioned that part of your job is to make sure that everyone on Earth is connected to the Internet. Is that still true?
That's still true. The chief Internet evangelist's job is to get everybody up online if they want to be online. And, of course, now I'm getting a lot of help because thanks to things like the low Earth orbiting satellite like Starlink or Kuiper or OneWeb or O3b, investments are being made to help make that a true statement that everyone has access to the Internet. If if they want it and if they can afford it. And that's another big issue, is making sure it's affordable and operates at a capacity that's useful. But I'm very excited to see so many companies making investments along those lines.
So are there some countries that still do not have access to the internet?
You know, well, there could be some island countries that don't have anything. A lot of them have some, but in every country, including here in the U.S., there are parts of the country that do not have very good access or any access, and it's often in the rural parts of the country where the cost of doing the interconnect can be very high, and the result is that it might not be affordable. In the case of Starlink, I think there's been an early subsidy, for example, in order to kickstart access to their low Earth orbiting satellite network. And there's a lot of work going on to try to drive cost out. Devices themselves could be manufactured in countries where labor costs are lower, and there might be ways of offering service that is less expensive. So all of that will help to get people up online if they want to be online. I'm hoping, frankly, that the LEO satellites will make it very hard not to get online, again, setting aside the question of affordability.
Dr. Vintzerf's book, The Internet is for Everyone, summarizes his belief that everyone has a right to be online. However, he has often criticized the divisive nature of some of the content online.
Well, I don't think that there's a simple answer using technology to filter bad stuff out. For one thing, the definition of bad could vary pretty dramatically. And in fact, it's even worth recognizing that science doesn't necessarily produce absolute truth either. And from time to time, we discover what we thought was true isn't anymore. For example, we discovered that the universe is not just expanding, but it's accelerating its expansion. And the reason why it's doing that is called dark energy, and we have no clue what it is, just as we don't know what dark matter is either. One big problem we have is that there isn't really a notion of absolute truth, at least in the scientific world. There's simply the best estimate we have of how the world works as of today. And tomorrow I might tell you we found out something different. The problem with that is that there are some people who are very uncomfortable with the idea that you might have a scientific theory that you believed in and your experiment confirmed for some 20 years or more, and then suddenly an experiment happens that shows that that theory is not correct. For some people, it leads to a kind of distrust of science because they say, well, you lied before, and so I don't believe you anymore. And of course, the answer is that's how science works. It falsifies theories in order to determine whether or not the theories are still correct. That's just to say that some content that we thought was good may turn out to be wrong. And that's not necessarily evil, it's just the way science works. But there's other content that's deliberately there to mislead people, to cause harm, to create emotional stress, to fool you into giving away important information that might lead to hijacking of your identity, denial of service attacks, malware attacks, all kinds of things. We have to deal with that somehow, but it may not be possible to deal with it using purely technical means. So we may have to tell people if we catch you doing some of those things, there'll be consequences. That means we have to have laws in place that allow law enforcement to deal with this problem. You know, the other problem we have is that the harmful behaviors may initiate in one country, but the targets may be in another country. So now we need international agreements to protect citizens from harm. And we need citizens to know how to protect themselves. They have to learn how to do safe networking effectively. On top of which, we might want to just get people to treat each other better. That's certainly a goal, but it's certainly not guaranteed, as we can tell from the most recent headlines about the Russian invasion of the Ukraine.
What do we do about the interplanetary internet? I mean, there is no law enforcement that's going to help if something attacks the network.
That's why we want to have discussions now about what the framework should be, what the policy framework should be for operating an interplanetary backbone. We want those discussions now before we actually go to the trouble of deploying a significant set of assets so that we have an agreement about how this should be done. So those are conversations that are just beginning.
Is Russia part of these discussions?
Well, the Russians are party to the consultative committee. They are part of the spacefaring countries of the world. The current situation probably means that there are discussions that are not happening or that are not including the Russians. I confess to you, I'm not tracking that very closely. But given all of the various sanctions, it wouldn't surprise me if Russian participation might still be difficult. However, it's still the case that the space agencies in Russia and the U.S. are still cooperating with each other because it's the only way we can maintain the International Space Station.
They have to. I mean, what are they
going to do? Yeah, well, they have to. I mean, this is why, even in times of conflict and tension, science and art have often been able to function in spite of the policy conflict, which could turn into a hotter conflict, which it has, of course, in the Ukraine. I'm a big fan of trying to maintain some kind of liaison, even in the face of these kinds of conflicts, because ultimately they will end, and we want to be able to work together after this period of tension is over.
Our distinguished guest, Dr. Vint Cerf, who is a vice president at Google, gave many talks about the Internet of Things. And in this section, he will give us an update about the Internet of Things gadgets that he has.
We did a little poll, informal, you know, non-scientific poll of a few of the engineers at Google. And we were trying to figure out how many devices do we have at home. Some of us had 25 or 30 devices, and, you know, that included laptops and pads and multiple mobiles and interactive music devices, things that you could talk to control various appliances using voice control. It's really quite astonishing how many devices have become part of the normal, you know, daily pattern of living. So the Internet of Things is quite real, and, of course, I still have nightmares about making sure that we don't become overly dependent on something which is brittle in its function. I mean, the last thing in the world you want is a brittle future. And I will have to say that the more I look at the things we rely on our mobiles to do for us, the more worried I get about what happens when the mobile doesn't work. You know, cascade failures of various kinds. Can't log into my email because I can't get a mobile signal. And since I can't log into the email, the business I was going to do has to wait. I think that we, as a society, we need to understand how to learn to make more resilient these computer-based applications and also have to learn how to be safer in this online environment, which means critical thinking. It means law enforcement. It means trying to understand the consequences of some of the applications that we're building. If you look at the online environment right now, you see a lot of amplification of voices, which to first order should be welcome because some of those voices might never have been heard before, except some of those voices are spewing misinformation and disinformation and hate speech and a bunch of other stuff. And the only way we're going to stop that is not with a computer algorithm, but with real training of our citizens about how to behave in the online world.
What do you think people can do to help make the Internet a better place?
Well, two things are very much top of mind for me. The first one is to draw other disciplines into understanding the impact of computer communications, computer-mediated communications, computer-based applications. And so I want psychologists and anthropologists and sociologists and maybe economists and certainly neuroscientists to help me understand and help others understand how these technologies influence and affect people. That's the first thing that I would like to see happen. The second thing is I'd like to see more attention paid to making these technologies more usable for people with disabilities. The third thing I'd like is to teach people, and especially children, how to think critically before they make any decisions. ask questions about the content that you're exposed to. Is this a legitimate piece of information? Is there corroborating evidence for it? If we don't teach people how to think critically about what they see and hear, then they will fall afoul of very bad misinformation. So it's important to teach people how to recognize good quality from bad quality information. There are three things that you can do in complicated situations like this. The first thing is to use technology to prevent a bad thing from happening. That might involve two-factor authentication to keep people from stealing your account, for example. The second thing you can do is to have a legal framework in which you can say to people, if you do these things, there'll be consequences. But we'll have to be vigilant about detecting, you know, technical breaks in the system where somebody is deliberately attacking a website or capturing and distributing personal information or doing other kinds of harmful things. We need to have a legal framework in which something can be done about that.
You've been listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Thank you so much for joining us today. And we would like to thank our distinguished guest, Dr. Vintzer, very much for his time and for today's interview. If you would like a copy of today's interview, please download it from our website, moderntechnews.com. That's moderntechnews.com.